And I'm not going to tell a joke up here tonight, I swear. I really am not going to tell a joke at all. I have told some jokes. No, I've told some jokes that are that have dropped bombs. Craters open up when I tell a joke. The bad thing about it was when the word got out that I was going to be a chairperson up here, I had to tell somebody, and so naturally the word got out, and everybody come up to me and started telling me jokes to tell you people. Everybody that knows me come up and tell me, now use this joke. And I have been listening to bad jokes for the last 3-4 weeks. I mean bad jokes. Let's get to the main point of our meeting here tonight, and that's the speaker. And I met Bill just this afternoon at lunchtime, and I would look for the speaker that was on the message didn't show up, so Bill's a run in here. Bill's from GSO New York, and he works in the PI section of New York. And I have to admire anybody that extends their AA work into that far, that high, that important a job, because it's a lifetime of service, AA lifetime of service, not only to GSO, state of Georgia, but each and every one of your individual groups. And I appreciate that, and I think it's important. It's important to me. I said I was going to introduce him by saying that he works in the PI office at GSO. And if you meet him on the street and get to talking to him and ask him about what he does and how he does things, if he is doing his job and if he is doing a good job, you can walk away from the conversation by saying, who was that guy? But let me introduce you to, so you can welcome Bill A. from GSO, New York.
Thanks, Matt. Hi, everybody. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. And I was kind of hoping he'd tell those jokes that left the craters. It would kind of make the way for me, I think, as things go. I've been known to tell a bad joke or two in my time, too. I guess, and that was one attempt at it. Uh-huh. I'm glad that air conditioning's coming. Don was talking about the jacuzzi situation. It's back. I guess first I want to start with something that I thought of when I first got the call to come here to Georgia, and that was to mention that I have a special affection for the state of Georgia and the southeast region, because one of the icons and one of the giants that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to meet was the regional trustee from the southeast, Joe P., from the world-famous Skyland Group. And, when I started to come around Alcoholics Anonymous, I got involved in young people's activities, and I started to attend the International Convention of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think just about everyone I attended when I first came around, Joe was there spreading his joy and love of service. And I always remember that he would say that he served for free and for fun. And he really exuded that, and it caught me. And Joe P. is one of the reasons I stand here tonight, I think, because he had that fire, that love of Alcoholics Anonymous that catches us and keeps us here for free and for fun and in love and service. So it's really nice to be here. I really want to thank the committee for bringing somebody from General Service Office to the Area Assembly. It's really a great opportunity for us who work at the GSO to get back at the heartbeat of AA, and that's state assemblies, area assemblies across the United States, where you people gather together to discuss the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we're able to be amongst you and one with you, we have a better feel. And you know, I know every year you sent a qualified and capable delegate to the General Service Conference, but when we at the office can come out and visit with you and break down the barriers that seem to build up of them and us, I think it does good not only for the office, but for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And I'd really like to thank Joycey and Jerry for thinking of me when the first speaker, actually, I was probably the last one on the list, but we'll see how that goes. Now, sometimes it's difficulty finding somebody at the office that's free, and generally we don't go on trips 2 weeks in a row. Last week I had the pleasure of spending time with our brothers and sisters in West Virginia, and it was a wonderful time, and I'm having a great time here in Georgia. So I'd really like to thank the committee for having the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous at heart, and spending the money to bring us down here. I think it's an important investment in the future for all of us. And I'd really like to thank the committee for appointing me with a sponsor, Randy S., here in Georgia. Not only has he been my spiritual guide, he's acted as my language translator. And now I just have to get someone to interpret for what he's saying, because I don't understand. Mitzi just came up to me before I started, and she said, "Now, you know, this is the tell the truth time. This is no GSLO talk, and this is where you come and tell the truth." And that's true. I really am here to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. But I would like to take just a couple of minutes to give a brief overview of your General Service Office and kind of the role that your staff members play. The General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous is located currently in New York City, where it's been most of all the time it's been in existence, except for a couple of misguided years in Newark at the beginning. And we're currently located up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan on Riverside Drive between 119th Street and 120th on Riverside Drive, right beside the Riverside Church, which is a really nice area to be in. And it is your General Service Office. If you come to New York City, please come and visit us. Come around, kick the tires, see how the thing looks. Meet the people who do you the work on your behalf. And currently there are 84 employees that work at GSO. Out of those people, 11 of us are, by definition of the job title, members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only time in your life being a member of AA looks good on a resume, really. For most of us, anyway. The 11 of us work in different committees. As Matt mentioned, I currently serve on the PI assignment, the public information assignment. And we rotate every 2 years, and we rotated last Monday. So I have 3 days of experience on the PI desk. And so if you have some really deep questions, I may have to come back in a year and a half. But I will try to do what I can. And the 11 members serve on different committees to try to make sure that requests are handled when the requests come into GSO. But as Larry, the area PI chair, really explained nicely in the workshop this morning, is that we're not the experts. And he was talking about himself as an area chair, and I say that too. At the General Service Office, we're certainly not experts in anything. All we are the keepers of the collective experience of the fellowship from around the United States and Canada over the years, and indeed around the world. And when you call, you don't call and ask for my expert opinion. What you want to know is what the common shared experience has said in these things. And that's what we try to share. And it's funny when members of the fellowship phone and I refer them to the literature, because that's where the wisdom is. The wisdom's in our literature, and it's oftentimes the best kept secret. You know, all the answers are in the book, And all we have to do is hunt them down. And that's our job, is to point out where you may find some wisdom and answers. And they'll always say, well, I understand that, but what do you think? And I keep repeating to them that it really isn't important what I think. What I think is probably less valuable than what they think, and they don't know. What knows is our common collective experience. And that's what we have at GSO. And if you don't send it in, if you don't share your experience, we start to lose the wisdom. We don't work in a vacuum or in a void. We work in a vital, vibrant fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you are the heartbeat of that. So keep sending in your cards and letters, and keep us full of the wisdom of the fellowship. We have a lot of people who work at GSO who are non-alcoholics, and it comes down to the fact that if you're working in the finance department and you're keeping track of accounts, whether you're an alcoholic or not doesn't really matter. It's the don't ask, don't tell kind of thing, except for the jobs that really require a member of AA to be able to answer the phone and say, this is our common shared experience. I'll get kind of how do I got there as I tell my story, but I did want to give you a little bit of an overview and tell you that it is your general service office. It's not New York. It's just where it is. It represents groups around the world, really, and we help as much as we can, whether it's in the state of Georgia or Saskatchewan, Canada. It doesn't matter to us. We're reaching out to wherever the hand of AA is needed. And we do that by virtue of your support of your general service office. And you do support it strongly. And the state of Georgia should be proud. You have like 63% of the groups here contribute to the general service office. And that's about 20 points higher than the average. About 43%, less than half the groups participate in that magic of touching one alcoholic in some remote land, and all it takes is sending in a contribution from time to time. And you know, some people bring up the fact that, you know, we use surplus from our publications to pay for services, and they figure that's not really being truly supporting. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but all I do know is more than half the groups are missing out on that heartbeat of AA that ticks off. Anyways, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about me and the drunk in me. As you'll notice, I didn't get here by accident, I don't think. I'm the younger son of Irish Catholic parents. I grew up in the west end of Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I grew up in an English-speaking family, in an English-speaking section of a province that was pretty much all French-speaking, so I probably started out a little bit confused. You know, that doesn't have much bearing on why I became a drunk, and being an Irish Catholic doesn't have much bearing. In Brooklyn, when somebody says, I'm an Irish Catholic alcoholic, people almost, they don't have to listen to the rest of the story because they're all part of that. But I grew up in a family, and I don't believe that either of my parents were alcoholics. Being an Irish family, liquor was, you know, a common accompaniment to any kind of family get-together, and I believe that there were members of my parents' family who were alcoholic and are alcoholic, but it really didn't have a great impact on my childhood. My childhood was pretty normal for a Canadian kid. I wanted to grow up and be a hockey star and do all the things that Canadian kids do. And, you know, I had a loving family. We weren't all that adept at showing it, but we knew we loved each other. When I was five, something happened that, in hindsight, I've looked back and I figured that this might have something to do with losing faith. When I was five, I had a rather serious medical condition which required that I get surgery, and I had my spleen removed when I was 5 years old, and at that time, it was before lasers and real minute surgery, so they cut me from my navel to my spinal cord to take my my spleen out, and I recovered, and they told my parents that I'd probably be a sickly child, you know, because it was a rather large operation. And at that time, one of my heroes in hockey was Boom Boom Geoffrion, who actually, when the first hockey team that you had in Atlanta, the Atlanta Flames, your first coach was Boom Boom Geoffrion, and he was my idol. Anyways, Boom Boom had his spleen removed, and he went back to starring in hockey, so I felt that I could too, and I did. I went and I played hockey, and I became a rough and tumble, or as rough a tumble for a short little kid as I could. And I went on throughout my childhood just enjoying hockey. I was a good student. My mom was a teacher, so it was by default you became a good student because you couldn't make mom look bad. And I think I was a bright, precocious kid. And I kind of had a happy childhood. We had a summer home, and there was nothing, there was none of the horror stories I hear from many people who talk about childhoods that were just, you know, oppressive. Mine was really quite a wonderful childhood. And I don't think there was anything in it that really destined me to become who I became. But I grew up, or I came of age, I guess I'd say, in the tail end of the 1960s. And at that point in time, there was sort of a revolution sweeping society, and experimentation was the phrase of the day, and I was part of that. I was 12, but I was part of that. I started to get loaded when I was 12, which kind of flies in the face of all that things that I told you about how normal my childhood was, but I guess I was seeking something. I don't know what it was. And I started to get loaded at 12, and I didn't get loaded on alcohol, and I'm not going to bore you or offend you with the whole pharmacology of what I did. Suffice to say, I used most substances known to man, animal, and model airplane. to seek enlightenment. And I did that from 12, and it progressed, and by the time I was 15, I probably should have been institutionalized for my drug problem. I didn't drink all that time because drinking was the other generation's choice, and I guess I was in the Pepsi generation. I don't know. But or that's a bad word in Atlanta, isn't it? Pepsi? Okay. Scratch that. So anyways, when I was 15, I spent most of grade 10 hallucinating. And if you ever had trouble with geometry, try it hallucinating, I'll tell you. So I was, I guess, 16 when I decided that I needed to do something about my drug problem. And I did. What I did is I started to drink. That was my solution. I sought out something that was legal, and to tell you the truth, my brothers and sisters, the feeling that I got when I sucked down that first or second beer, that sense of ease and comfort that they talk about in the doctor's opinion, that is what I had been searching for all those years of experimentation. That feeling I got when I drank, that sense of ease and comfort, that sense of being all right in my own skin, that's what I had been seeking, and that's what I found in drinking. And alcohol became my solution to living. And it really was a solution, and I know, you know, most of us, it comes back and bites us on the derriere, but at that point in time, at 16 years of age, I had found the solution. I found the freedom from drugs. I found a way to live life. I found something I could do with mom and dad, which I hadn't been able to do with all the other things I've been doing. And it was just really a way to live. And I was so grateful to have found alcohol. It was my friend, and I drank every day, I believe, from the time I started to drink until the time I stumbled into Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the beginning, it wasn't a problematic kind of drinking. It was, as I say, a solution. And I finished high school, and I went to a junior college. And in Quebec, we had a different system of education, where for 2 years you go in this junior system, and then you go on to university. And as I said, I was bright, so I didn't really have much, I didn't have to work that hard in high school and junior college. But once I got to university, things became more difficult. And being a true alcoholic, I think I sought out the easier, softer way. And I spent most of that first year, more time was spent in the student lounge than the library. I guess I was doing social research, but I was in a literature program, so I don't know how that works out. But after my first year and not going to exams and not really doing much schoolwork, I decided in my wisdom that I was much too intelligent for university, you see. I had been reading Dostoevsky when I was 13. I was a precocious reader. I knew more than these people were trying to tell me. And they were the establishment. They were trying to warp my thinking into their way. And I was a free thinker. So being so intelligent, too intelligent, I left university after 1 year to enter my journey on the Canadian version of the Horatio Alger story. The success story, starting from the bottom, moving up. And the bottom is where I started. I started working in a warehouse for a friend of mine who had opened up an import company. He was importing games and things from the Orient. And I started working in the warehouse, and upward I went. I think it was about 3 months, and I became the warehouse manager of this place, which meant that I told the Filipino guy where to put the boxes. So. My management skills weren't really being tested, but I had a title. And, man, that sauna's on. I get the steam. Take some water. Anyways, I worked there for about a year and a half, and in 1976, the company decided to move from Montreal to Toronto. There was an election in Quebec, and the politics changed. Many companies moved to Ontario. And the company moved to Toronto, and I did too. And for those of you who don't know it, for someone in Montreal to move to Toronto is like is dying. It's like dying. Dying, you know what I mean? Montreal is a city that's known for its nightlife. It's joie de vivre, as they say. It's joy of life, the French fact, the international feeling. Toronto's nickname back in those days was Toronto the Good. Need I say more? Anyways, the real conflict I had with Toronto at that point was the bars closed at 1 o'clock. In Montreal, they closed at 3 o'clock, but I knew places that never closed, so I could live my life to the fullest. And when I moved to Toronto, I worked. That's another aspect that some of us alcoholics have. We become workaholics when we're good workers when we're not loaded too bad. And I worked hard and I played hard. That was my philosophy. And unfortunately, my playing hard was back in Montreal. Almost every weekend, I made the journey back to Crescent Street in Montreal and partied from Friday 1 o'clock until the time I left Sunday late and drove back to Toronto. Needless to say, it was an expensive way to spend time, and it really was no way to live. I had not given Toronto a chance. I had no friends. I was alienated, and that alienation pushed my drinking a little bit further. I started to drink to fill that void, that sense that I had in Montreal, that sense of camaraderie. I didn't have it, so I started to drink more, and I started to have the morning drinks more often. I had drank in the morning on weekends, but we called it brunch. You know, an egg and 16 beers, that was brunch. But in Toronto, I started to have to drink on my way to work. I just have one just to get the shakes out, and I would work long hours in the warehouse. At that point, I was managing about 15 people. The company had grown, and it was doing well. And I was management, so I didn't get paid for after five, which I thought was a good thing, but not a good thing on the bottom line, I guess. But I believe that my time after five was kind of my time, so I had a little fridge and I sort of drank on the job, which isn't the greatest example a manager can give to his employees, but I rationalized it that way. Anyways, I did my time in Toronto. I did 3 years, hard time, and I couldn't live in anymore like that. I wanted to return not only to the bars, but my family was in Montreal. There were things I missed. I didn't want to live there anymore. So I moved back to Montreal for the same company as the sales representative for the Quebec region. And I found, I believe, the perfect job for this alcoholic, and that was to be a traveling salesman. It afforded me the kind of flexibility that I needed to live life. And that meant that I could drink the way I liked to drink. And, you know, it was a solution and it was working. I guess I'm one of those people, like many of us, we surround ourselves with like people, people who drink like us. And I had this group of friends from the time we were young. We grew up together through the 60s and the 70s, and I was too stoned to go to Woodstock. That kind of sums everything up. Anyways, we developed, and over time, stuff started to happen in the early 80s around me. Friends of mine started to being incarcerated for federal offenses for long periods of time. Other friends of mine started to fall by the wayside. They would be injured in accidents. Some of them started to be hurt in their sort of nefarious professions. They started to get involved in the underworld and they were getting hurt, and some of them disappeared. I remember vividly waking up one morning to see my friend Frank's picture on the front page of the morning paper, being wanted by the police for having shot two people the night before in a bar. And Frank was a violent drunk, and that night his violence went over the edge. And Frank is still in the penitentiary, and it's a very sad thing. I didn't have any help to offer him at that time. Today, I believe that I might have. Another thing happened in 1982, just about this time, my friend Budgie, who was much like me, who went through the whole drug scene and then found a solution to that problem in drinking. He was 29 in 1982 and he died. His liver gave out. And I remember vividly at that point in time us going up to the hospital room, and he was yellow. And his eyes were yellow and he was bloated, and we'd bring him liquor. And I don't say that with any kind of pride or bravado. It just shows the level of sickness that I had reached. And my friend Budgie was 29 when he died. And that's not the kind of thing that we had looked at when we looked upon all that potential we had back in the 60s. This isn't the kind of stuff that was supposed to be happening. When I came around, there was a questionnaire, and one of the questions was, did you seek lower companions? And I had difficulty with that question because I never had very far to look. My brother David, my big brother Dave, was a worse drunk than I. And for many years, my brother David was my marking post. Many of us seek out these people and say, as long as I'm not as bad as, I'm doing all right. And I had that built-in thing of having my big brother, my hero, be my guidepost. And in 1983, my brother's alcoholism really had reached a bottoming point. My brother and I drank very differently. He was a binge drinker, I was a daily drinker. But it all really comes out the same at the final result, I guess. But in the fall of 1983, my brother's partner and a friend and I, in our great wisdom, did the classic intervention where you go and you say, okay, we can't watch you killing yourself anymore. You know, if you're going to do that, get a little room down on St. Laurent Street, which is kind of the Bowery of Montreal, and go drink yourself to death because we can't continue watching this, or get some help. And some other friends had started going to treatment in the United States for their drug and alcohol problems earlier in that year. And they had come back to Montreal, and funnily enough, they had gone to AA, which I found funny because none of them drank as much as I did. But at that point, there was nothing else for them to go to. And they really were alcoholics. I mean, when you drink a bottle of cognac a night, it counts. They used to say, well, it's not my problem, it's the coke. But, you know, what? Who's going to call that? So anyways, I found out about from them treatment centers, and I arranged for my brother to go to treatment in 1983. And on December 5th of 1983, I poured my brother onto AA Airlines. That's American Airlines. And we do not endorse or finance. Anyways, my brother left in December 5th to go to treatment, and it was quite a tragedy. I mean, my parents were the ones who funded this little voyage. And because my brother and I, though both being gainfully employed, him being the vice president of a company, couldn't rub two nickels together at that point in time. So David left December 5th, and you would think that I would react to that and become a sensitive, supportive son, because my parents, this wasn't in the plan. This wasn't what the bright spots of their life were supposed to end up doing. But instead of being supportive and there for them, I just went crazy that month of December. I got drunker than a monkey the whole month. And I remember just not being able to be there. And to tell you the truth, that post that I always had was gone. And I no longer had that, as long as I'm not as bad as, because he wasn't there anymore. So I got drunker than a monkey, and I remember them phoning me from the institution in Minnesota, and they called to tell me that my brother would be released on January the 5th, and that if he had any chance for long-term sobriety and to save his life, the answer would come in going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, of course, concurred with their judgment, and I said, oh, you're damn right he's going to AA. We spent all that money. We're going to make it worthwhile. And then they had the audacity to ask me about my drinking habits. And I, of course, was offended. As I sat there in my underwear with a little pile of white stuff on the table and beer cans scattered across the house, I said, now wait a second, it's him who's got the problem. I'm fine. I drink, but I don't have a problem. And at this point, my flexibility at work had taken a strange turn. I couldn't any longer go out to work. And that was one of the dangerous signs that I found in my brother's drinking. He couldn't get out of the apartment. He couldn't answer the phone. He couldn't answer the door. And at that point, that's what had started happening to me. I had started to lose that sensibility that I could drink. Because I was always a stand-up kind of drunk. I couldn't talk much, but I could stand up. And I used to think I looked good, but I question that now. But I could stand. My brother was a fall-down drunk, so you know, people used to put cigarettes out on him and stuff. It was rather ugly, actually. So I had started where I couldn't do the appointments anymore because I was drinking pretty much around the clock. I had found that cocaine made drinking a full-time occupation. I could drink around the clock, and it was great. So I was having trouble doing appointments, and I found that I could, by this point, only do about two appointments a week. And they had to be at 10 o'clock a.m. Any earlier than 10 o'clock, I was much too shaky to go out. And any later than 10 o'clock, I was too drunk. And that's what my life had come to as my brother returned from treatment. And we lived together at that time in an apartment, a flat in Montreal. And they caution you when you go back out of treatment, and even AA, we kind of tell people, you know, you may have to give up your old habits and your old haunts and your old friends because their interests and your interests are no longer the same. But my brother didn't give up me, and he came back, and I look back now, and I didn't have the innate love, the power to love, to get rid of the booze. I had a fridge full of beer. I had other things in the house that endangered his sobriety, and I didn't have the love of my brother to do anything about it because my own alcoholism had reached the point where I had become self-obsessed with drinking. And my brother would go to meetings, and I would send him to meetings, you know. Well, you going to the meeting? And he'd say, well, yeah, I'm going. And he would go, and you know, he had a rough time coming back, and he would come back from the meetings, and I'd be loaded, and I'd say, well, how was it, all right? And he'd say, yeah, it was pretty good, good speaker tonight, talked a lot of interesting things, and you know, he was doing the attraction rather than promotion deal, because he didn't push it at all. He just kind of talked, and he would go out, and I would get drunk, and I remember he went to one meeting one night, and it was kind of a stuffy group. It was like in the wealthy area of town, and everybody was kind of their nose ups and stuff. He didn't feel real comfortable there. He liked the downtown meetings where the real alcoholics go, I guess. So anyways, he went there that night, and everyone had mink on, and he felt that he probably didn't fit. So he came home early, and I'll be forever grateful to the Hampstead group for being how they were that night, because he came home early and found me on the couch, passed out, with a cigarette smoldering in the couch, and I was pretty much on fire. So he put me out, and and he said, geez, man, you got to stop doing this. I said, well, I'll try to quit smoking. But I think that was his, you know, warning sign that something had to change. And something did change. My life just got worse and worse, and I got more and more cut off. And inside, I felt myself just sinking. And I would go to the mirror, and I would look, and I would see not so much me, but my brother. I would see how he looked when I decided he was sick and he needed help. And for 5 months, I watched my brother go to AA, and then in May of 1984, May 21st weekend, as a matter of fact, I went to the country just outside of Montreal, a bucolic, beautiful eastern township town in the mountains near Vermont. I went for a christening, a really sacred kind of occasion, you know, where you welcome new life into the family of man and all that stuff. And I just got drunk, that quiet, solid, desperate drunk that we get at the end, where it doesn't work anymore. You don't even get drunk. You just feed the beast. And I knew that that weekend something had to change. So I came back from Sutton that Sunday, and I walked into the apartment, and I finished the last 3 Labatt Blue in the fridge. And I said to my brother, I said, you know, I think maybe I might, a lot of qualifications in this thing, I might want to go to a meeting with you tomorrow. And he said, well, he thought that might be a good idea. Because he had been making some travel arrangements for me. And I said, no, I kind of had realized that 28 days somewhere wasn't the solution for him. The solution was attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So he said, well, he gave me the book, the big book, and he said, here, try to read this, and because I knew I wasn't going to sleep much. I hadn't slept in probably a couple of years. I had gone into comas from time to time, but I really, and I hadn't had enough to drink. 3 Labatt Blue is not going to put me out. So I spent that night reading the book, and I read it, as I said, I was a quick read, but I read and I didn't understand anything about the program or anything. I read it, but what got me was at the back of the book, the stories. And that's why the stories are there, so they can get into the whole heart of an alcoholic and touch them somewhere very deeply and very profoundly. And that happened to me. And that night I read those stories, and that morning I woke up, May 21st, 1984, and I had fought many mornings for many months to not take that drink in the morning. To say, well, I won't drink this morning. I'll not have a drink this morning. And I never made it. And that morning I woke up and I said, I won't drink this morning. And I didn't. And I haven't had a drink or a drug since that morning. And that's by the grace of God and you fine people who showed me and my brother a way out of a life that was truly painful. And I don't want to spend too long talking because the heat and the football game, as Randy informed me, are coming. But I do want to spend some time telling you about the wonders that have happened to me in my time with you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's truly the miracle. It's not so much the miracle that I was a drunk. I think it's the miracle that I'm a drunk who's recovered. And that's the witness that we give in Alcoholics Anonymous to the millions who still suffer, is that yes, we were like that, and we don't have to live like that anymore. And I came to AA that night after not drinking in the morning. I spent the afternoon shaking, reading that book, not wetting the bed for the first time in a long time. And that afternoon I went over to my folks' house, ostensibly to have supper, but really to borrow enough money to put in gas in the car so I could make it to the meeting. And I had some thoughts, which is a dangerous thing for an alcoholic with a couple of hours sobriety. As I was there, I walked in, my dad said, want a beer? And I said, no, not now. And he says, are you going to go to AA like your brother? I said, yeah, I am. And he said, well, that's good. And I think he was just relieved that we'd no longer be drinking his beer, but I truly believe that he knew that something had happened very important in his son's life when David went to treatment and changed his life. So I sat there and I started thinking that maybe, because I really felt bad. The first day was really hard. I really felt sick and I knew what would work. I knew what would make me feel better, and I knew it was going to kill me. So I thought that maybe it would be better if I went to AA when I felt better. And if you're new and you're starting to wonder, you don't come to AA because you feel good. You come to AA because you're sick. And then you start to feel good. So if you have delusions like that, don't listen to them. I believe God in his wisdom got me through that little bit of denial or delusion and got me to my first meeting just in time, just in the right time. And I got to a magical meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And it was in the Monday Central group, the oldest group in Montreal. It's about 62 years old now. And it was really just great. The man who spoke that night was a man who had 32 years of sobriety. He was a charming man. He was about 72. He was a dapper gentleman, well-spoken, funny. He just looked charming. And I said, he can't be a real alcoholic. But then he told his story. And he was just a nut. He had been a brigadier general in the Canadian forces in World War II. He went through World War II drunk all the time, became heroic and all that stuff. He didn't remember anything. He was decorated for all this stuff, and he doesn't remember much. And he came from a very prominent family, and he had everything going for him. And he ended up selling aluminum siding in Houston, Texas. And the people in Houston, Texas finally got him sober. And they began his journey. And he touched me so deeply, I'll be forever grateful for Rowan for sharing that night. And for a guy with 17 hours or 17 minutes of abstinence. Sobriety is really a big stretch at that point. You know, I was sitting on my hands so it looked like I wasn't waving. You know? I was shaky. So anyways, I listened to Rowan, and then later a man took a 38-year cake, and it worked for me. I was really blessed, I think. And when I went there, I went down the steps, and I know that an alcoholic had something to do with building the steps, because each of them was a little bit different, the height. And it was a long walk. So I stumbled in, and the secretary said about how the newcomer was the most important person in the room, and I was a little bit embarrassed, to tell you the truth, that my brother had put you all up to this, you know? I mean, he set the whole thing up. He told you I was coming, and that's why you put on all this show and stuff. And unless my brother has been running ahead of me to all the meetings I've gone to, I was wrong. This is just the way you treat newcomers. You love them, and that's it. So I began my journey in AA that night, and I haven't looked back, and it's been a journey beyond my wildest dreams. And to tell you the truth, my friends, my sobriety has been a much more difficult road than the life I lived when I was drunk. And I don't know if that's because I didn't recognize most things when I was drunk, but things have happened to me in sobriety. I was one of the unlucky AAs who get the material things real quick. I came in here on the edge of that job, and I got sober on Monday. I got a new job on Wednesday. Within 6 months, I was making more money than I had ever moved into a penthouse apartment, had the mobile phone, the car, all this stuff. And I figured, this is great. The promises are coming true in my life. Because they said something about financial insecurity somewhere in there. But I was of the alcoholic type who was under the delusion that there was nothing else wrong with me other than I drank too much. Other than that, I was a really nice guy, and I was a nice guy. There was nothing wrong. I had never been married, so I'd never lost families. I'd never been incarcerated because I was awfully lucky. All I needed to do was not drink and help you folks, because you really are in trouble. I know that, because I listened to the stories you had. So I was the two-step program that is pretty popular in some corners of AA, where you do the first step and the 12-step, and you don't need any of the others. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I lived. And for 5 years, I paid no attention to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a home group, I had a sponsor, I had everything that I could do. If you had a committee, I was on it, and I was probably chairing it. But I didn't do the inner work that was necessary. And I didn't think it was necessary because I had all the stuff. All the outside stuff came. I had the money, and then I got the woman, and the woman had a kid, so I had an instant family. This was like the fast plan. I was rebuilding my life. And my brother and I were very heartwarming that we were going to have a chance again to have a family relationship with my parents, because for 15 to 20 years we were drunk, we were gone. I remember so many Christmases pulling my brother out of the potatoes, picking him up. It wasn't the Cleavers, let's face it. It wasn't a joyful place for my parents to have two sons like that. But anyways, we thought, now we're sober, it's time. And to tell you the truth, it wasn't time. God had different plans. And my brother and I got sober in 1983 and 84. In 1985, we started to notice that my father started acting a little differently. He had retired, and we figured it was just the adjustment, but it was more than the adjustment. He started to get irritable, forgetful, and all that stuff. So we went and saw a doctor, and my father got diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And we were ready to rebuild the relationship, but it wasn't time. And my father deteriorated over the next 3 or 4 years, and it was a very sad thing. My father was my hero. He was the fastest skater I'd ever seen. He could skate like the wind. He was a man that I had aspired to be like. And by the end, he was in diapers, and it was just, it was hard. And my brother went and saw him every day and changed diapers and did stuff, and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And anyways, my dad died in 1989, and my brother and I had both dreaded that day, figuring that would be the one thing that might do it, that might drive us back to drinking. Because the Irish have a strange habit when people pass on. We get drunk and talk about what a fine fella he was. And the family had the wake, and we didn't drink. And that was because half the room was filled with you. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We help each other through things that should kill us. And it was at that point in time, at the wake of my father, we were there and we were sitting with my mother. And my mother, obviously she was emotionally traumatized by the situation, her husband dying and stuff. But we didn't really realize what was going on until she started to say, "Where's your father? Where's Dad?" And he's in the box, Ma. He's in the box. But she kept going on, and we just looked at each other and we said, "Oh no, this isn't fair." And it wasn't fair. It's not fair. Life, my friends, is not fair. But we realized that all that time we had focused so much on my dad and his disease, we had not noticed the changes happening in my mom. And my mom got diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Soon after she kept looking for him, we brought her to the doctor, and he said, "Well, you know, you're going to have to do something." And she went in a home, and for about another 4 years, she lived, and we lived another long goodbye. And it was one of the most painful times. Simultaneously, all those things I had got, I lost. I lost the woman, I lost the little boy, I lost the job, I lost all the money. When I was 7 years sober, 37 years old, I declared bankruptcy, and I ended up living on my brother's couch. And it was at that point that I turned to the real solution that AA offers, and that's the 12 steps of recovery. And I got a sponsor who helped me and loved me and showed me the way. And since that time, many different things have happened. My mom passed away in 1994, 10 days before my 40th birthday. And all that time, my brother had been, he quit his job, he sold his company, and he really just cared for my folks. And he would be there daily, and I would go periodically because it was hard, because my mom didn't really recognize me. She knew I was okay, but she didn't really know who I was most of the time. And on March the 4th, 1994, I went over in the morning, and we took a little walk down the hall, and we were walking back up, and she said, "Oh, I have to sit. I have a sore back." And as she sat down and we sat down, Mom had also been diagnosed as having an aneurysm behind her aorta, and it blew that moment when we sat down. And she went, "Oh," and she fell in my arms. And I was the one who didn't go every day. This was the kind of thing that Dave's supposed to be there for, but it was me. And she fell in my arms, and I held her, and the medics came, and we went to the hospital, and for 4 hours, my brother slowly bled to death. And my brother and I were there, and we held her hand, and we patted her head, and we told her to let go, to just go. And that moment when the life of spirit of my mother left is probably the moment I have been most spiritually touched in my life. And if nothing else would ever have happened in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, for that moment, I would owe you forever and ever and ever. Because it really was a miracle that that woman had two sons sitting on her bed holding her. Two sons who any other time before we met you people would have been drunk, this is the kind of thing that would get us up good and drunk. But instead of dying sad, alone, she died in the bosoms of the boys that she gave birth to. And that, my friends, is the miracle that AA offered to the Archer brothers. And it's the miracle that we offer around the world in different circumstances and different situations. But we do recover, and we do learn how to love. And that's not something I knew before I met you. Anyways, after my mom passed, I had a life change. I didn't want to be a salesman anymore. I didn't know what to do. I thought I'd be an alcoholism counselor because I figured that was a thing to do. And I volunteered for about a month and a half at a place, and I said, boy, I don't want to do that ever. It's just too depressing, folks. So I went back to university at the age of 42, the same university that I had left 20 years ago in disgrace. And I went back, and in June of 1997, I completed my degree with distinction from that university. And later that month, on the 23rd of June, I married a lovely woman, Audrey, who became my bride. And a month later, we moved to Japan together to teach English. And that was just a remarkable journey. And I'll tell you, the most remarkable thing, other than, you know, experiencing that other culture and all that difference, was Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well and breathing and kicking in Japan. And I was a member of the Nagoya International Group, and it really was an anchor to my life in Japan. It really, really sang the power of this fellowship goes across many, many different ways, language, culture. It works. When I arrived in Japan in the end of July, and 3 weeks later, the General Service Office called me to come back for an interview for a job in New York. And I had applied earlier, and things happened. And being a Canadian, there's some immigration aspects to working at GSO that make it a little bit problematic. So anyways, 3 weeks after I go to Japan, I come back. Warren Stafford got the job at that time, but they told me they were still interested. And actually, it was exactly a year ago today that I rode my bicycle through the rice paddies to Kasugai Nishi High School for the last time. It was my last day of teaching in Japan a year ago. And on the Monday, I flew to New York City, and I began that part of my journey in New York as a member of the General Service Office staff, working for you in your General Service Office. And it's been just a wild year of growth and wonder. And they told me in New York that the staff said, you know, we have no worry that you'll be able to do the job. You know, you can do the job. We're just not sure whether you can handle New York, you know. And they said the worst part will be finding somewhere to live because the rents are stratospheric, and what they want a lot of money for is really hovels in Manhattan. And when Audrey and I moved there, we said, we've got to live in Manhattan. It's where Seinfeld is, you know. It's really where the true New York is. And we looked at places, and it was pitiful, as they say, pitiful, pitiful, pitiful. So finally, we got a real estate agent in Brooklyn looking for us. He's a member of AA, and he was looking. And he phoned Audrey one morning, and he says, you got to get over here right away. And she said, well, I'll come later. He said, no, right away. I got a rent-stabilized one-bedroom in Brooklyn Heights. Got to go. So Audrey went out. She phoned me from Brooklyn. I was at work. I was just maybe 2 weeks in the job, so I was really nervous. She says, you got to come right now. I said, no, I'll come after work. And she said, no, you got to come right now. So I went to Lois Fisher, the staff coordinator. I said, Lois, she says, you got to go right now. So I got on. She gave me the address, and I got over to Brooklyn, and I took the subway, and I started walking down the street. And it struck me that this was familiar territory. It looked familiar to me. The brownstones looked like something I'd seen before. And I don't know if any of you have read the book Pass It On, the story of Bill Wilson, how the AA message reached the world. But there's a picture in there of an apartment or a brownstone that he and Lois lived in when Abby came to visit that first morning in 1934. And the address was 182 Clinton Street. And the address of the apartment that Audrey was at was 200 Clinton Street. It was 184, 200. So I'm two doors away from Bill and Lois's place in Brooklyn Heights. And every morning, as I go to work for you wonderful people, I walk by there and I say, how you doing? And it really is a kind of magical set of circumstances and coincidences when I think back, you know, when I think back that 65 years ago, that man and wife were suffering the ravages of this disease. And I look back 100 years ago, we were all pretty much doomed to a painful, sad, alcoholic death. And here we are, as Matt said, on the turn of a new millennium, even though some will argue that's a year away. For those people, you're going to miss a big party. But as we turn that, I think we need to look back to where we came from. And we came from asylums, jails, and now we're in a hotel like this, speaking to the power of the program, the power of our higher power, that we can recover. But we should never, ever take this for granted. And as we turn into a new millennium, I think we have to realize our awesome responsibility to make sure that this is available for the child being born tonight. And each one of us, as we go back and do God's work in our home groups, if we can just remember where we come from and not make mistakes that will endanger our future and the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think we're starting to pay back those men and women that brought us this message that has saved our lives. And I'll just end with saying that every morning and every day of my life, I thank God for letting me find Alcoholics Anonymous. And every day, through being with you people, I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for letting me find God. I love you. Good night. Go watch the game.